From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Mickey Mouse goes to Haiti.
I pay $12 for a shirt that they pay the workers 7 cents to make.
It's terrible.
And to make a tremendous fortune. And all we're asking them to do is come to Haiti with us and improve conditions for the workers. The workers are asking for 60 U.S. cents an hour. It's nothing.
Nothing, really nothing.
And they won't even go down there and consider it. It's nothing.
It's terrible.
Activists have proclaimed this week Disney Week. We'll look at the multinational sweatshops abroad. Also, a conversation with Fair about Disney's buyout of ABC and its effect on the news. And Walt Disney, the Dark Prince, a rare look at the man who started it all. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that Vice President Gore has longstanding ties to fundraiser John Huang. Amid the controversy over the Democratic Party's aggressive foreign fundraising, it turns out that Gore has his own links to the embattled Huang. In January 1989, when Gore was a Tennessee senator, he traveled to Asia with Huang. The trip was paid for by the same Buddhist organization that sponsored the controversial Los Angeles fundraising event for the Democratic National Committee in August, attended by Gore. And President Clinton is expected to fill some cabinet seats at a news conference this afternoon. Aides report Clinton has been working hard on forming an economic team for his second term. Treasury Secretary Rubin is staying, and Democratic activist Bill Daley of Chicago, the brother of Chicago Mayor Daley, looks to be a likely choice for Commerce. Clinton is also looking for a new labor secretary and a new head for his National Economic Council. Clinton also is expected to use the news conference to announce the fate of Attorney General Janet Reno. He met with Reno last night and said the session was wonderful. Senior advisors report he's decided to ask her to stay on. New Mexico Congressmember Bill Richardson also looks to be a good bet for UN ambassador. And thanks to everyone who called in yesterday suggesting questions I might ask at President Clinton's news conference today. The questions range from child labor to the CIA crack story to questions about a black cabinet member to nuke waste disposal, also questions on police brutality, Leonard Peltier around NAFTA, and domestic violence. So thanks for all that. Incumbent Ron Kerry is holding the lead in the fight to remain Teamsters president. Kerry has roughly a 7 percentage point edge over James Hoffa, with 43% of the ballots counted. Neither side is predicting the outcome based on the returns so far. But Hoffa already is challenging about 11,000 ballots, and a spokesperson says Hoffa's campaign believes the election probably will be decided by the challenge ballots. Hoffa is the son of former Teamsters president Jimmy Hoffa. In DuPage County, Illinois, three former prosecutors and four police officers have been indicted for their roles in a murder case. The seven are accused of falsifying and concealing evidence in the case of two men who were sent to death row for the 1983 rape murder of a young girl. The men were later acquitted. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin isn't laughing. He says a comic strip that depicts a character, apparently a militia member, practicing to shoot a stinking ATF man, is a serious editorial misjudgment. Rubin is in charge of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The Ernie comic strip appeared in some 200 newspapers across the country yesterday. General Motors has agreed to spend nearly $4 million to buy back thousands of older GM vehicles. It's part of a much larger settlement GM signed last year. The settlement is designed to make up for exhaust spewed into the air by more than 500,000 Cadillacs recalled in 1995. And this international news. More than 100,000 protesters clogged the streets of Belgrade, and a group of 40,000 marched to the home of Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic, where they were pushed back by heavily armed riot police. And Burma's military rulers widened their crackdown on anti-government unrest, tightening security in Rangoon and arresting members of the country's opposition party. Meanwhile, the Burmese official media is saying that four U.S. Congress members visited the onshore site of the controversial Yadana gas pipeline in southeastern Burma earlier this week. The team, led by Congressmember Dennis Hastert of Illinois, toured the Kambuk base camp run by France's Total SA, the media reported. The visitors were accompanied by the Burmese energy minister. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
Hi-ho, it's home from work we go. Hi-ho, 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 it's home from work we go.
Hi-ho, hi-ho. This week, activists around the United States are drawing attention to the unethical labor practices of the Disney Corporation. Many of the products sold in the U.S. bearing the images of Disney characters from Aladdin to The Little Mermaid, Pocahontas to The Hunchback of Notre Dame are manufactured in sweatshops in Haiti. Haitian workers who make the T-shirts many in the U.S. buy for children can't even afford to feed and clothe their own kids. Disney workers in Haiti earn poverty wages, work in poor conditions, and are prevented from organizing.
I have been working for 13 years. I've got a family to take care of. I'm exhausted because I'm working hard in a state of desolation. It makes me forget that I even have parents. Because of this tough situation, my children can't eat. I'm living on credit. I'm working hard, and I'm not getting paid enough. The quota they give us is hard to make. When I go home, I collapse. Because we work too hard, and we have no food. This shows how desolate our lives are. We are like the living dead. The boss has benefits and we have nothing. The boss can say anything to us and we can say nothing back. And even the Haitian state doesn't say a word. It is because of God that we don't do anything wrong. So I ask God and the international community to speak up for the Haitian people.
They want us to work like crazy the whole day. If we go to the bathroom, they say it's wasting time. Even when we work overtime, it's only when we are back at home that we can wash up. They should consider us like human beings. They don't see us as human beings at all.
What would happen if they tried to organize themselves? What would happen if you tried to organize to defend your rights and organize a union?
If they knew it, they would fire us.
They'd rather close the factory than pay 58 cents an hour.
That's what she said.
I'd like to send a message to the American people. If they send these clothes to be made in Haiti, if the Americans can't give a living wage to us, to the Haitian workers, they shouldn't wear the clothes we have made for them in Haiti. That would be better for us.
The voices of Haitian workers, excerpts from a new video called Mickey Mouse Goes to Haiti, produced by Barbara Briggs and Charlie Kernigan of the National Labor Committee. We are now joined by Yannick, who is a Haitian woman. We're speaking to her in Port-au-Prince, who has been organizing Disney workers. When, on one of my trips to Haiti, I met with Yannick and many of the Disney workers. We were in a small, crowded room that was lit only by candlelight, because even after the coup, workers are afraid to speak out and talk about their working conditions. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Yannick.
Oh, thank you. How are you?
Good. Why don't you tell us, we've just heard some of the voices of Haitian workers, but about the conditions today. I think many people in this country think things changed a lot after the coup, and that they don't expect to hear these kind of descriptions during this administration of René Préval.
Well, actually, the same conditions, you know, are still the conditions are still the same. I mean, I recognize the voices, you know, that you just heard, and you know, the conditions have not changed, except that I should say, with the kind of pressure that the factory owners, the Haitian factory owners, receive from the international community, and also the work that we're doing here, and now they pay the 36 good, you know, that's the minimum wage, and in that one factory in particular, and Classic Apparel, and they raise the quota. I mean, they raise the quota, but they raise also the price of the quota. Now it's 50 good, but you have to make 300 dozen of you know, whatever pieces that you, whatever operation that you have to do. And then now, yeah, that's the thing. They just raise it to one Haitian dollar. When I say 50 goods, you know, that's you divide by three, you get it in American dollars. Uh-huh.
So we're talking about something like 17 cents an hour?
Yes, about that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's all. But and also there, well, I should say that in that one particular factory, you know, they accept the union to be to be there. But as far as the 13 left, you know, it's a battle. And you know, most of those factories don't accept, you know, unions in their factories, and the conditions are the same. You know, the water, drinking water, is filthy. The bathrooms are dirty. You know, and whatever you say, they give you temporary suspension, or they just fire you. And you know, the conditions are still bad, really bad right now. Yeah.
You know, we invited Disney to participate in today's program. Unfortunately, they refused. And perhaps, given the conditions you're describing, it's no surprise. But let's talk about exactly how it works, because I know when I was doing pieces down there on Disney, they would make this point, that they don't run the factory, but that they contract out and they don't have control over these subcontractors in Haiti.
Well, in a way, yes, they don't have factories in Haiti, but they have contractors. They have three contractors, LV Miles, H. Cutler, and Waterbury. You see, those people, two of them do not have factory in Haiti. L.V. Miles has a factory in Haiti. It says L.V. Miles, that's the same name. It's number 30 in the industrial park. But as far as the other one, they are owned by Haitians, okay? But, you know, it's a small elite. A small Haitian elite owns those factories. And what happened, but Disney know they're using his name. And also, they know, because of all those pressures, all those news, all the newspaper clips, newspaper articles and everything, you know, the news is talking about the situation in Haiti. They send people, they even send people from the embassy to come to inspect.
The U.S. embassy.
Yeah, the U.S. embassy in Haiti. And, you know, people send people to inspect those factories and talk to the factory owners. But they never talk to the Haitian workers.
You know, this doesn't surprise me, considering when President Aristide first came to power at the beginning of the 1990s, he said, he promised that one of the first things he'd do was increase the minimum wage. At the same time, the Agency for International Development, that's the U.S. Agency for International Development, put out a report saying that they were against the increase in the minimum wage. So I think it's interesting the relationship the U.S. government plays in supporting these U.S. corporations.
That's the same thing, because the same thing is still going on. Like whatever piece of information we're trying to get out, you know, from those factories, like the fact that they were violating the minimum wage law. In Haiti, the labor code says if the cost of living gets 10%. You know, higher. They should raise the salary of the workers also.
Yannick, we're joined right now by Barbara Briggs, who helped produce that video we just heard excerpts of, Mickey Mouse Goes to Haiti. And Barbara, you're with the National Labor Committee, which has initiated this week of international action against the Disney Corporation. What kind of action has been taking place this week?
There have been actions and will be actions in over 50 cities in the country, including in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Burbank, Dallas, Texas. Here in New York, we're planning our demonstration for tomorrow, and I hope we can talk about that a little bit later. We're expecting a really good crowd, including, you know, people dressed up in costumes. We're having a chorus from New Jersey. We're having school kids from fourth graders from Brooklyn who've been working on getting permission from their parents.
And this is in front of one of the large Disney stores in New York City.
Yes, this is in front of Disney's very, very fancy store on Fifth Avenue, which is the very big upscale shopping district on Fifth Avenue and 55th Street.
What kind of response have you gotten to these protests, which are not only actually in this country, but around the world, and not only around sweatshop conditions, but around Euro Disney and around Japanese Disney?
At this point, Disney is still really attempting to hold strong. They have begun writing letters back to write to them. And in fact, we spoke with a reporter a couple of days ago who had just spoken with Disney executives, and he says they're very upset because they've received 6,000 letters from grade school kids. 6,000 letters. Well, we got one of those letters, and they are still claiming that the Disney workers in Haiti make 2 to 3 times the minimum wage, that these are beautiful jobs, that these are lovely jobs that help support families and develop the economy, which is absolute nonsense. In fact, when we were in Haiti with Yannick recently and spoke with workers, we interviewed many, many workers, and we found that many Disney workers are still making absolute rock-bottom minimum wage, 30 cents an hour, and they seem to be averaging because they strategize in order to make quota and sometimes, occasionally, some days make the incentive. They seem to be making about 33 cents an hour. I'd like to talk, perhaps in a little bit, about what 33 cents an hour buys, because it's absolutely pathetic.
Talk about it.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, why don't you tell us what 33 cents an hour buys?
Absolutely. Because we actually brought back pay stubs from workers who were making minimum wage, 30 cents an hour, 33 cents an hour. That comes to $202.64 a day. It comes to $13.20 a week. And believe it or not, I mean, wages are just, prices are not all that different in Haiti. 65 cents for 47 cents for a pound of rice, 60 cents for a pound of beans. A small can of tomato paste would be 66 cents. So we're actually finding that the workers are spending 70-80%, sometimes even more, of their wage just to get to work and back and to buy a small breakfast and a small lunch for themselves. For example, average, and this is a lot of workers pay more, but average to get to work and back on a crowded tap-tap, a crowded truck, is about 27 cents. A meager breakfast of spaghetti with some bread and some coffee would be about 67 cents. A lunch with rice and a vegetable stew is about $1. Buy a glass of juice, hot, very, very hot in those factories, and they don't have access to potable water. Buy a glass of juice, that's 27 cents. You're already up to $2.21 out of the $2.64 wage that you're bringing home. That's 84 cents.
Barbara Briggs, let me ask you, why did you focus on Disney? I mean, all these facts and figures you've just given us give us a good indication, but there are other corporations who work around the world who do the same kind of thing.
There are absolutely, and we're, and it's absolutely clear that it's part of the system of exploitation of workers around the world. Disney is not the only one. We focused on Disney because we have a long history. I suppose we began because we have a long history with Haiti, and we saw a number of factories producing Disney products. We're now seeing at least 10 factories in the country doing Disney production. We focused on Disney because Disney claims to be a family values company. They put a culture out to our children. They put movies out, and they claim to support family values. And here we are seeing full-time workers working 40 and more hours a week who are not making enough to feed their kids, who are going to bed hungry. Their kids are going to bed hungry. They try to send their kids to school, and they get kicked out because they can't pay for the few school supplies they have to buy.
Barbara, we have to wrap up.
It's just not moral.
But since you have put out, the National Labor Committee, a number of reports on Haiti, can you give us your number for listeners who'd like to call in and get these reports?
Absolutely. Our number is 212-242-3002.
That's
212-242-3002, and we'd very much like people to call. We'll send information. We'll help you get involved.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and we'll certainly continue to follow this up. You were talking about the kids around the country who are writing to Disney CEO Michael Eisner. Well, they're performing skits, and they're working with other students. We were out yesterday, one of our reporters, Brother Shine, in New York City. In Manhattan, a group of kids from the Berkeley Carroll Elementary School in Brooklyn went to another school in New York City. They're all fourth graders, to talk a little about Disney.
Well, we're talking about child labor and how it's how kids get beaten and they don't get a lot of money and horrible conditions in their factories.
Okay, how did y'all find out about it?
Well, we got a letter. Time for Kids gave us a magazine to read, and it had an article in it about child labor. And it told us what it was about. And then we started getting into the subject, and we started writing letters to companies like Disney and Nike and Reebok. And they started writing back, and that's how it happened.
Okay. How do you feel about these companies that have child labor?
I feel very bad because I don't think they should have to work so long because they work about 21 hours a day and they have no rest or they can't talk or anything.
They can only use the bathroom twice a day and people walk around with guns threatening them. And they don't let them bring candies to the factory because if they're working on a white clothes, they might put candy on the clothes and get it dirty.
Children from the Berkeley Carroll Elementary School in Brooklyn who came to visit with students from another school in New York City yesterday to talk about the situation of Disney workers. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at other aspects of Disney Corporation. Stay with us.
Just whistle while you work and cheerfully together we can tidy up the place. So I'm a merry tune. It won't take long when there's a song to help you set the pace. And as you sweep the room, imagine that the broom is someone that you love, and soon you'll find you're dancing to the tune. When hearts are high, the time will fly, so whistle while you work.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In a move that rocked the entertainment industry, the Walt Disney Company has announced the departure of Michael Ovitz, one of the most formidable power brokers in Hollywood over the last decade. Joining us now to talk about Ovitz, as well as the effect of Disney after it took over ABC, is Jeff Cohen. He's director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a media watchdog group. Jeff, tell us a little about who Michael Ovitz is and if this has any significance, his resignation.
Michael Ovitz had been one of the most powerful people in Hollywood because he headed the talent agency that represented so much power that he was known as the dictator of Hollywood. The interesting thing, all these people, by the way, they go from one studio to another. The interesting thing about Ovitz in this current controversy about Disney in China is that it's Ovitz that apparently gave the green light to the movie about the Dalai Lama. And the Chinese authorities are not happy with Disney. Everyone knows that Disney is moving into China. They want the market of 1.2 billion people. And it's just very curious now that movie that Ovitz gave the green light to is causing this kind of trouble.
Why did Disney agree to this to begin with, clearly?
Well, that's the big question, because mostly Disney and these huge multinational media conglomerates like to avoid controversy, especially when they want to cozy up to the Chinese authorities, the government authorities. So that's the real question, is why the green light in the first place? At this point, they can't stop it, but the way they've undercut the movie is they've told the Chinese authorities basically, okay, we won't distribute it internationally. They've sold off all the foreign distribution rights, so other companies will be doing that. But what was curious to us when Disney took over ABC was some comments from Michael Eisner, the head honcho of the company. And this is what he said at the news conference when they announced the takeover of ABC, quote, "There are many places in the world, like China, India, and other places, that do not want to accept programming that has political content. but they have no problem with sports, and they have no problem with the Disney kind of programming, unquote. So what Eisner was saying, I believe, is we can break through to a lot of governments that don't want a free flow of information because we have this content. In other words, we'll take the politics out. We will eliminate the controversy. What kind of message does Michael Eisner send to journalists who work at ABC News? It's basically, the message is, if you want to promote up the ladder at ABC News, don't propose a six-part special on human rights and labor rights in China. You know, it's not gonna fly. So that's one of the problems of having a multinational conglomerate like Disney being the employer of these journalists at the biggest TV news network in the country. ABC's the biggest.
Have you seen any examples of censorship since Disney took over ABC?
Yeah, it's real contradictory. I mean, clearly, one guy who left Disney in a big huff and it was very controversial was the talk show host, Jim Hightower. And Hightower left ABC Radio Networks after Disney took over. And Hightower was one of these guys. He's obviously not a timid soul. On his radio talk show, he was making fun of his employer. He was saying things that were like, he once on one show, this is August 19th, he said that it was interesting to him that Disney was taking laborers, like homeless people, and giving them contract labor, but making them buy their uniforms and tools, when at the same time, this is Jim Hightower on ABC Radio Networks, Hightower says, at the same time that the Disney chief executive officer, Michael Eisner, was earning $78,000 an hour. Now, that's not the kind of thing that ingratiates you with your owner. And he had also talked about how it's bad that too much power is concentrating in the hands of these media conglomerates. And he had talked about Disney's role with, cheap labor overseas. And then he got fired. Now, Jim Hightower to this day believes that his firing had something to do with the comments he made about Disney. People have this mistaken notion about Disney as a benign company with benign products. If you're a journalist at ABC News or a commentator, and you know that Disney is involved with sweatshop labor in the Caribbean, they're profiting from it. If you know that Disney's theme parks sometimes cause environmental and other problems for the local inhabitants, and you want to report on them, your willingness to do so may be hampered, especially when all you ever hear from the executives at Disney is the word synergy. When Eisner, at the opening news conference, when Disney swallowed up ABC, Eisner talked about how the synergies go on and on and on. Synergy means you use one part of your company to rub the back of the other part of the company. You don't have news going after sweatshops when your clothing line is benefiting from them. You don't have news investigating labor rights in China when your marketing department is trying to get into China. So when all you ever hear from the top brass in the Disney company is the word synergy, and you're a reporter, it really sends you a message to avoid certain subjects. During the Kathy Lee Gifford controversy, Primetime Live put out what was seen by many to be a puff piece defending Kathy Lee. And it was really a sorry and soft piece of journalism. I can go back in Primetime Live history, and you know, it is their second biggest news magazine show. They did a segment back in 1990 called Tragic Kingdom, and it was about how Disney theme parks in Central Florida have a very negative impact on democracy there, on the environment there, on the local communities there. And now, and it was really a tough piece on corporate greed at one of the world's biggest companies. Now there's no one at Primetime Live who believes they could do such a segment. So, you know, that's the simple point, is we are in a real problem in this country as global corporations take more and more political power internationally, and they employ the journalists. That's why there's this growing media and democracy movement that FAIR is a part of, which is demanding, it's obviously not going to happen next year, but over time, we believe that the broadcast TV news departments should be taken away from these companies. They should be made independent, because as long as Disney employs the journalists at ABC News, none of these stories we're talking about will be covered adequately.
And I guess it'll give true meaning to the term a Mickey Mouse operation.
Right. I mean, that's the problem there. I mean, keep in mind, as soon as Disney, in the terms of Mickey Mouse operation, as soon as Disney took over, one of the first things that the brass did at ABC News was they sold out to Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds on a totally accurate story about how the tobacco companies manipulate how much nicotine is in each cigarette and how they do it in the manufacturing process. And after the takeover, ABC sold out the journalists, made a major settlement, agreed to pay millions of dollars to the tobacco industry's lawyers, and they apologized on the air on ABC, not once.
Diane Sawyer did it, right?
Diane Sawyer did it once. Not once, not twice, but three times. One of the apologies was during Monday Night Football. It was a complete sellout on a story that was totally accurate. There was nothing wrong with the story. I kept calling the ABC spokespersons during the time and said, you've apologized in your what you read on the air three times. And I want you to point out anywhere in the transcript from the show, it was a day one segment, where you made this allegation. And it was obvious that they were apologizing for statements not made. And what was happening there is the brass of ABC, especially the general counsel, ordered the sellout. And we learned later from a Wall Street Journal reporter that when Disney was negotiating to merge with ABC, one of the things they asked ABC, you going to handle that suit with the tobacco industry? And they were assured that the suit would be settled.
They said that the journalists had said that nicotine was brought in from the outside and put into the cigarette, as opposed to what the journalist said was that the company was manipulating the amount of nicotine right. That was already in the cigarette.
Right. There was no one at ABC News that believed it was inaccurate in any way. It was just a corporate sellout mandated at the top to please the new owners, Disney. It was a white flag seen round the network. And I really feel sorry for the reporters. There was the on-air correspondent was John Martin, and the producer worked on this story for months is Walt Bogdanovich, or Bogdanich. And, you know, these guys, they're tainted. Let's assume they take on some other industry, and there's a good reporters. Forever, the corporate PR flack from the other side, you're the ones that ABC had to apologize for. I mean, it totally taints these very solid reporters, and it sends a message to ABC News reporters, I believe, that now that Disney is here, they will not stand they will not stand behind you. They don't want anything that will hurt their bottom line, or their favorite word, corporate synergy.
Jeff, thanks very much for joining us. Your magazine Extra, which has printed a lot of this information over the last year since Walt Disney took over, what's the number if people want to get a subscription?
It's 1-800-847-3993.
One more time?
1-800-847-3993.
Jeff Cohen, Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And as we continue on our disrobing Disney theme, we'll now take a look at the man who created the Magic Kingdom. He's been revered as an American hero who built an entertainment empire that would nurture the child in each of us. But Walt Disney had a darker side. He was a confirmed anti-Semite, a virulent union buster who fought his own workers to the edge of bankruptcy, and an informant to J. Edgar Hoover's FBI for 25 years. We're joined by Mark Elliott, author of the unauthorized biography called Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince. Mark, you talk about how Walt Disney got his start, left Kansas, came to Hollywood in 1921.
Unfortunately for him, he was a year or two too late, as the colony of Hollywood had already been carved up into more or less seven power units or major studios, which he found he was kind of left out in the cold. He did work with a partner, this team that they put together, Ub Iwerks was his partner, were able to sell a cartoon character to a major, which I believe was Paramount Pictures. It was Oswald the Rabbit. And then Walt Disney learned his first great Hollywood lesson, which is that when you work for somebody in Hollywood, you work for somebody. You are not credited with being the artist. You're an employee. The long and short of it is that Oswald the Rabbit was stolen by the studio, and Disney was left without a character and without a career. So he turned around and invented a new character based a little bit on Oswald and a little bit on Charlie Chaplin, his then idol, and that became the first incarnation of Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse went on to be the backbone of what became the Walt Disney Studios. But there are some interesting side lights to this story. One is that it taught Disney a very bitter lesson about dealing in a town where you're kind of in an advanced oligarchy of power, and you are the independents. This very same problem that exists today in Hollywood for independent filmmakers. Nothing really has changed in the last 70 years in that sense. The other part, and the darker princely side of it, if I may, is that Disney had come from a fundamentalist family in the Midwest, a step above a Pentecostal Holy Roller environment, and was fairly shocked to be exposed to so many Jews in power. And the focus of much of his later political vitriol toward liberalism and unionism is really rooted in the fact that he felt locked out of what was then commonly known as the Old Boys Club in Hollywood, all the Jewish European immigrants who had somehow come and found an industry that they were allowed to invent, which, of course, is a story fairly well known, how the Jewish immigration west began as they were kicked out of the New York film business by Thomas Edison and that gang. Arriving on as far away as possible from all the so-called trusts that Edison had set up to prevent what he considered lower-class, vaudevillian, Lower East Side, Jewish-led film operations from existing, going so far as to copyright film from Kodak and then not releasing it to anybody except people he wanted to make films. So when Disney came to Hollywood, he found himself actually having gone in the wrong direction. Had he gone to New York City, which was in 1921 not only an enclave of non-Jewish filmmakers and film studios, but also at that time the head of or the capital of animation, where he probably would have done very, very well early on. Instead, he went to Hollywood and found himself locked out on every level, social, emotional, in terms of his background, in terms of his thought processes politically, and there would be a lot of that remaining in his future films and his future life.
How did he express his anti-Semitism?
Well, it came out early on in a film, interestingly enough, The Big Bad Wolf. The Big Bad Wolf was a cartoon, a 3 or 4 minute cartoon, or rather, excuse me, a 10 minute cartoon that he made from the popular story about, you know, the pigs and building the right house and the secure house that even a wolf can't blow down. That little film became the biggest moneymaker for Disney for years and years and years because it coincided with the onset of the Depression and seemed to represent to America hope and a kind of a very Rooseveltian theme that the only thing that you have to fear is fear, and that if you build a strong house and a strong foundation, you will survive the threat of this wolf that is knocking at the door, the wolf of the Depression. Well, in the first version of that film, the wolf tries to come into the house from several different ways of one of these pigs. And one way he disguises himself is as a Jewish peddler. And it's done in a very unattractive, unappealing, disrespectful manner. The nose, the cape, the idea of the Jew as this Shylock-type peddler, as the liar, as ugly, all the cliches. And it so offended the Jewish community, especially in Hollywood, which was the Jewish community in film, that in all subsequent releases for the 10 years that it played in front of feature films throughout the nation and eventually the world, that scene was cut out, much to Disney's anger, by the way. He felt there was nothing wrong with it, but nevertheless, it was and has never been seen since. Then, of course, later on, during the 40s, when Disney formed the Motion Picture Alliance in 1941 with a couple of other right-wing fanatical filmmakers to rid Hollywood of what they considered communist and left-wingers, there was a very thin veil between the language used to express distaste for liberalism and unionism and Jews. It was what he called, what he considered, a Jewish conspiracy to take over Hollywood. And so he really led this anti-communist diatribe and 10-year attack on the industry, and was responsible for a lot of the blacklisting that later went on by virtue of using Judaism as a form of attack.
Well,
he also attended several, two different sources, he attended several anti-American Nazi party meetings prior to the outbreak of World War II for America.
Who told you that?
Well, there was an animator who had attended them with him, and there was also a female reporter from a magazine at the time, Collier's, who had reported the event. You have to remember, in those days, those meetings took place in places like Madison Square Garden, not down in the basement of somebody's home. Mm-hmm. And people like Charles Lindbergh were also up on the podium. It was peacetime, and there's also been part of the defense of that has been that since one of the things my book went on to say and prove through FBI documents that Disney was an FBI informant, that he was there taking names. But I'll tell you, that for me is a stretch.
Now, before we get to his FBI history, what about the issue of racism? So often anti-Semitism and racism go hand in hand.
Well, racism in not just in Walt Disney, but in all of Hollywood has always been the problem that that the film can't hide because it's right there on the screen. Disney was among the fiercest of racists, I guess you could say. Not so much on screen because most of his films were dealing with cartoons. However, if you look at one of his later real life features, "Song of the South," you see a depiction of a black man that so offended people that film has never been released in video and has never been seen in movie theaters. I think the last time it was shown was on the early Walt Disney programs. The other side of it is, unfortunately, and it's a story I always hate to mention, is that the one black employee that Disney had at the studio for 25 years was his personal shoeshine man.
Huh. Well, we'll continue with Mark Elliott, author of Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince, in a minute.
It happened on one of them zippity-doo-dah days. Now, that's the kind of day when you can't open your mouth without a song jump right out of it. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. My, oh, my, what a wonderful day. Plenty of sunshine heading my way. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. Mr. Bluebird's on my shoulder. It's the truth. It's actual. Everything is satisfactual. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. Wonderful feeling, wonderful day. Yes, sir. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. My, oh, my, what a wonderful day.
I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now! As we continue with Mark Elliott, author of Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince. Mark, tell us about Walt Disney and union busting.
Well, probably one of the least known strikes in Hollywood was the 1941 animation strike against the Disney studios. The big strike, the one that took place in 1945, which really began the long and still ongoing division between liberal Hollywood and conservative Hollywood, kind of began in 1941. Disney's studio was the last animation studio not to be unionized. All the others had either gone union or left town. The Fleischer studio had left town, had gone down to Florida and ultimately out of business. One or two others, I think MGM, shut down rather than being unionized. Warner Brothers did eventually unionize. The last one to go was Disney, and he felt that, again, it was all tied up with a kind of a tortured psyche that he bore. He felt that because he was indeed Uncle Walt, that as the paternal figure to all these young animators whom he had trained, whom he had plucked out of art schools, who he had delivered from creative obscurity, that he had given them much more than any union could ever possibly offer. And so when they voted to strike for a better wage, they were among the lowest paid creators in town for better hours. They had to work. It was the famous, if you don't come in on Sunday, don't come in on Monday rulings. They worked very long and very hard times, especially when they were working on feature films, the so-called golden era of animation, when Disney would go into one of his 24-hour, 48-hour marathons and expecting everybody to do it with him. When the union struck, Disney refused to settle. And believed that at the core of this union were a bunch of communists who were not only looking to take down his studio, but use that as a springboard to develop a much stronger hold in Hollywood. This became a very ugly, dark strike. It lasted a long time, and Disney would not settle. Finally, his brother, Roy Disney, sent or arranged with Nelson Rockefeller, who was then the head of a cultural commission for overseas development of American culture, had Walt Disney sent to South America. While Disney was down there in Latin America, in Brazil, I believe, Roy settled a strike in 24 hours and basically gave the strikers what they wanted. When Disney came back, he was so outraged and offended that he swore he would never make another feature animated film, and for a very long time, almost 11 years, didn't turn to feature real live-action features, and as a result, let almost all his animators go. Every one of the strike participators in the strike were fired or reassigned to a place where they all were but were fired. Three or four of the animators later on, 4 or 5 years later, when Disney invited HUAC, the House on American Activities, to come to Hollywood. The invitation came via the Motion Picture Alliance, of which he was a founder. Disney named three animators in his friendly testimony to HUAC, none of whom ever worked again for any studio as in Hollywood as animators. Named them all as communists. They had absolutely no communist affiliation, and one of them was Jewish. And
Dave Hilberman.
Arthur Babbitt had married the girl who played Snow White and was an out-and-out activist for the strike. And there was a third who was a union leader, and he led the 1945 strike, and he never worked again.
Why don't we talk about Walt Disney and the FBI? In a minute, I want to get to how the media responded to your book and how the Disney family, employing William Webster, the former head of the FBI, tried to discredit you. But what about Walt Disney's relationship with the FBI?
Well, Walt Disney had a very bizarre relationship with J. Edgar Hoover. And when you look at both men, they really weren't that far apart in personality or credo. They both were loners. They both had built organizations from nothing. They had both come out of no political background to assume roles of great political power. Disney in Hollywood, Hoover with the FBI in Washington. Both were rabid anti-communists, and both had very rigidly run organizations. If you recall all the stories of FBI men being fired for not wearing ties, you know, and all of that, that very rigid FBI look, that the G-man look that Hoover always sold his organization on. And then the Disney Studios, which were run kind of like an animated FBI. So there was a symbiosis there without question. Plus, Disney looked to Hoover as a father figure. Without getting too complicated here, Disney had problems relating to fathers and mothers. You can see it in virtually every cartoon, every feature cartoon he made, where he explored that theme of lost parents and children who might have been adopted, or even through The Lion King, you see aspects of the old Disney themes.
In fact, you say he was too adopted. Is that right?
Well, he had a fear he was adopted, which was actually more important to whether or not he was. I'm not sure he was. But what's important about this story is that he believed, for these purposes, is that he believed he was adopted and went to Hoover to try to get the FBI's help in finding out who had adopted him, where he came from, in effect, who he was. And Hoover, in return, enlisted Disney as early as 1936, according to documents that we now have, to be what was known as a special agent in charge contact, which meant that Hoover would send agents into the field, particularly in Hollywood, a favorite target of Hoover's, and those agents would make contacts within the studios, and those contacts would then report to the agents, who then would in turn report to Hoover. Well, there is a 600-page FBI file filled with documents from Disney, where Disney is clearly designated Walt Disney SAC, which is Special Agent in Charge Contact, and loads of reports from him, many of which were redacted, and some I was eventually able to get unredacted, that clearly showed he was, well, among other things, one thing that I was able to piece through was that during 1941, I believe the FBI came in right after the strike and asked Disney for all of his employee records, which he turned over to them, which is a clear violation of everybody's civil rights. Even then, the government took those documents, and many people whom they investigated and later accused of being communists were their backgrounds were explored via the use of those documents. So clearly, Disney was using two rules that simply don't apply in the laws of America. He was assuming guilt until proven innocent, and he was given open access to the government without proper authority or subpoena to the private files of employees. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of what he did, leading up to his association and his campaign to bring the House Un-American Activities to Hollywood, which he did in 1945. They were subsequently thrown out of Hollywood. Then they returned in 1946, the difference being that when FDR died, so did a certain type of liberalism in America, and the onset of the Cold War brought a new fear, a new round of fear to the sense of the communist takeover in America. And suddenly, HUAC had gained a new sense of importance. And Disney, I think, was the fourth or fifth friendly witness to testify, and did quite a job.
Now, you talked about how Disney used the FBI files of his workers, but how do you have proof that he was a spy for the FBI?
Well, I have proof by virtue of the fact that in the files themselves, and one or two are reproduced, that he is listed as a contact. The only difference between a special agent in charge and a special agent in charge contact is that a special agent in charge works for the FBI on salary, and a special agent in charge contact does it for a patriotic duty. It's a designation they no longer use, by the way, special agent in charge contact. But Disney was listed as a contact. He was listed in several memos by J. Edgar Hoover that refer to him as a contact, and the FBI also came in and wanted Disney to make propaganda films for them, which I believe he did. And his studio was also taken over during World War II as a propaganda factory, which he willingly participated in. So his spying was, we're talking about internal spying here. He became one of the eyes and ears for Hoover in Hollywood. He went to several meetings, several left-wing meetings, several funerals of prominent artists, and always those meetings were reported on in the files as to who attended, and these reports came from Disney, who was there and what they said.
You write that when Walt Disney died, then-Governor of California Edmund Brown flew flags at half-mast throughout the state of California. You had Ronald Reagan saying there just aren't any words to express my personal grief. President Johnson sending his condolences, and J. Edgar Hoover also sending a telegram to Lillian, Walt Disney's wife. And you say afterwards that that same day, Hoover ordered Disney's name deleted from the FBI's records as an active SAC contact, special
That's
agent
right.
in charge contact. How do you know this?
Because it was in the file. there was a memo. I believe the telegram that Hoover sent to Mrs. Disney, Lillian Disney, handwritten on that telegram were instructions to handwritten on a copy of the telegram that Hoover kept were instructions to have Disney's name deleted. That's we have that in Hoover's handwriting in the FBI files. It does seem that they did try to expunge a lot of Disney's names, Disney's name from a lot of the files, and nobody in those days really anticipated a Freedom of Information Act actually allowing Americans to get the files of other deceased Americans of a certain nature. And so these files read as if they were never meant to be seen. And the ones that have any real damage are almost completely redacted. And you really have to kind of piece together incidents and play a little detective game to find out the extent of all their involvement. But it's obvious from the amount of redacting that they did in 600 pages that there was an awful lot that the FBI still, 50 years later after Walt Disney died, 50 years after World War II ended, that they didn't want you to know what went on. And the question is why? I mean, what could possibly be in those files that they still refuse to release?
Again, we're talking to Mark Elliott. He's author of Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince. Now let's talk about your story, Mark, and that is when your book was published, or even before it was published, the campaign on the part of the Disney family, together with former FBI Director William Webster, to discredit your findings, not to mention to discredit you yourself.
Well, that's always my favorite thing when somehow the focus of what I write shifts to the focus of who I am, and it becomes a case of attacking the messenger to destroy the message. They released this huge report to the media the day the book was published, which of course exploded onto the front pages and put me on a defensive position, or so they hoped. The worst thing that they did was that they hired William Webster to say Walt Disney was never a spy for the FBI. What they didn't say, and what Webster didn't say, was that he had long ago resigned from the FBI, was now in private law practice, and his law firm had been hired by the Disney family and had been the Disney's primary legal representation for years. So there was a massive conflict of interest involved in Webster being an impartial spokesperson for a family. He never said, I am the Disney's attorney, and Disney was never. He represented himself as former FBI head William Webster, and I can say to you that Disney was never an FBI informant, which was, of course, an outrage.
One of the things that Herbert Mittgang,
he's the one who broke the story.
Right, an investigative reporter for the New York Times, emphasized was that Walt Disney had been even more heavily involved with COMPIC, the FBI's 1940s investigation of communist infiltration in the motion picture industry, than you had even believed to begin with.
COMPIC was a secret operation that the FBI had begun, which preceded the HUAC hearings, and Disney's name is all over COMPIC. There was a screening of a movie, of a Danny Kaye movie, that was an independent film done by Samuel Goldwyn. And because it was an independent film, this situation sounds vaguely familiar today, but in the 40s, trying to get an independent film distributed was an impossibility in America. Really, virtually, there was no independent film movement. That film, they finally were so desperate that film was run in a firehouse, I believe, in Las Vegas. The only place they had to hang a sheet up and run a 16-millimeter print of this film that Sam Goldwyn did. Well, Disney went to that screening. And all the people involved in it were subsequently investigated by the FBI, and the company that I believe ran the evening, that coordinated the evening, was brought up under charges of subversion. So Compic was a deadly virus in the 40, of which Disney was a kind of a human hypodermic needle.
Mark Elliott, author of Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince. To get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!